Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the just-released International Atomic Energy Agency's report on Iran's nuclear ambitions. One of the world's leading experts on nuclear proliferation, David Albright, joins us. The author of Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies, he was with the IAEA's action team from 1992 to 1997 and became the first non-governmental inspector of Iraq's nuclear weapons program. Then we will discuss the final exit of the scandal-plagued Italian Prime Minister, who, assuming he steps down as promised, leaves behind a pile of debt exposing the Eurozone's third-largest economy to even more market speculation as an economy that is too big to bail or fail faces an uncertain future. Alexander Stille, the author of The Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture Was Taken Over by a Man Named Silvio Berlusconi, joins us. We will discuss the tawdry legacy of this titan of sleaze who combines the worst of Donald Trump and Rupert Murdoch. Then finally, Ari Berman joins us. He is a contributing writer for The Nation who has written extensively on American politics and the intersection of money and politics. We will discuss yesterday's election results in Maine, Mississippi, Ohio, Arizona, where it appears voters punished Republicans for going too far, and they also showed up at the polls to reverse laws that took away voting rights, immigrants' rights, women's rights, and workers' rights. Joining us now is David Albright, who is the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, a nonprofit, nonpartisan institution dedicated to informing the public about science and policy issues affecting international security. From 1992 to 1997, Albright was associated with the International Atomic Energy Agency's action team, and in 1996 became the first non-governmental inspector of Iraq's nuclear program. He has written extensively on the subject of nuclear weapons and their proliferation. His latest book is Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Albright.
Well, good to be here.
And the IAEA's report, much anticipated, has just come out, and it makes a credible case that Iran has carried out activities relevant to the development of a nuclear device. What is a device as opposed to a weapon?
Well, it's a weapon, at least the way the IAEA is considering it, is something you could put on a ballistic missile and have high assurance that it would survive the launch and detonate over a target. So in a sense, it's a weaponized nuclear device, and where the device could just be something that at best you would detonate underground. It could be large, no real thought to having it be aerodynamic, such as if it was a warhead for a missile or but one thing that is true is that this device that the IAEA is talking about was only about a little bit over half a meter in diameter, which for a first-time effort to make nuclear weapons is remarkably small. I mean, to put it in context, in 1990, when Iraq was crashing and to get a nuclear weapon after it invaded Kuwait, it had a design that was more than double that in diameter, 1.2 meters in diameter, and Iraq was struggling to get it down to 0.8 and never succeeded before the 1991 war started. So the size of this device that Iran was working on in 2003 suggests, and the IAEA reinforces this, that there was significant foreign assistance to the Iranian nuclear weapons effort.
And for historical reference, the Fat Boy, that was Hiroshima. What was its diameter?
Over a meter.
Uh-huh.
So Iran, by 2003, was thinking of a miniaturized nuclear weapon, and the intent was to improve it to the point where it could be put on a ballistic missile. And the IAEA is concerned that some of the work to do that has continued after 2003, and that Iran intends at some point in the future to actually finish the work. And so that's partly why the IAEA has released this report, is it feels that there is a secret, or worries there's a secret nuclear weapons program in Iran. It's a major violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it's trying to call this problem to the attention of the international community, and also try to get more pressure put on Iran to actually address the IAEA's questions about what Iran has done in the past on, and may continue to do on this particular topic.
So, David Allred, it does seem that the IAEA in this case has gone to lengths to, I suppose, because of what happened with the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or the non-existence of them, they have a whole section called credibility of information. What's your reading on that since you've been associated with these inspections in the past?
Well, you always have to worry that you're being led astray by a member state who has a political agenda. And this is a lot of this is intelligence information, information acquired by various intelligence agencies inside Iran. It's documents that Iran intended to keep secret. The IAEA had to try to get as much information as possible from a different collection of member states. It also went out and interviewed people on its own, both in Iran and outside Iran. It's tried to get Iranians to talk about the information that the member states provided to the IAEA. So it's tried to do a lot of things over many years. It started around 2004. And so it's tried to take many steps to assure that the information is credible and coherent and the IAEA isn't being used. Now, I would say it's as long as I've sort of been tracking IA work, which really it started in an intense way in the early 90s, they've always tried to do this. I mean, they did it in North Korea in the early 90s. They did it in Iraq in the 90s. They did it in Iraq in the run-up to the 2003 Iraq War. So they're a technical organization that tries to assess and figure out what's going on and our country's violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So it's always pretty thorough. And I think this report is another example where they've gone the extra mile to try to make sure that what they're reporting is accurate.
Again, I'm speaking with David Allred, the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security. He was associated with the International Atomic Energy Agency's action team and in 1996 became the first non-governmental inspector of Iraq's nuclear weapons program. He's the author of Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. So this report basically, I guess the highlights are that Iran is working on a project to secure a source for uranium suitable for the use in their undisclosed enrichment program. There's evidence that Iran has been provided with nuclear explosive design information, and that there's also evidence that they've been testing conventional explosives to trigger a nuclear chain reaction, and there are at least 14 progressive design iterations for a missile warhead to deliver an atomic warhead to a distant target. Now, you've already said that the indications of the diameter of the device indicates that it's a sophisticated device that could be put onto a ballistic missile. I was under the impression that there's a likelihood that AQ Khan provided a Chinese design that the Pakistanis have on their missiles.
Yeah, the IAEA interviewed one of the members of the Khan network. I believe it's the one that was located in Switzerland, one of the members of the Tinner family. And the IAEA was told that the network had provided Iran with nuclear weapons design information. And there was worry in the IAEA that the design information provided could have been for a weapon more sophisticated than the weapons design that AQ Khan provided to Libya. And that the design provided to Libya was basically a Chinese design that China had given to Pakistan or given to AQ Khan in the early 80s. And so what design would that have been? If it's more advanced, the IA investigation in the Khan network had shown that Khan had access to more advanced Pakistani designs, and there's a worry that the Khan network people may have given Iran some aspects or some information about these more sophisticated Pakistani warheads. And one of the challenges Pakistan was facing once it had the Chinese design was how to miniaturize it. I forget its actual diameter, but it's more like 0.8 meters in diameter. And Pakistan was trying to reduce its diameter and was successful, went through six iterations of designs before they finally tested one in 1998. So there's a great deal of worry that Iran got a big head start as a result of the AQ-Khan network.
And, of course, the only reason we know about the AQ-Khan network, at least in large part, is because Libya sort of flipped. Gaddafi decided to cooperate with the West and revealed the extent to which he'd been getting nuclear information from the AQ-Khan network. But my understanding is that the United States and the CIA have never, ever been able to debrief AQ-Khan, so nobody quite knows exactly who he peddled to whom.
No, that's right, and he's a notorious liar. So, I mean, it's, you know, his confession, which is now publicly available, is just littered with, you know, half-truths and lies and distortions. So, I mean, it's, you know, there's also truth in it, but you've got to read the thing very carefully to sort out facts from fantasy. And so even if they could interview him, you're not sure what you're going to get. I mean, it's certainly, I think it's very important because in some cases, the information is so overwhelming that he can't, you know, he can fill in or admit to things. But it's as important to get to the people who worked with him who've been much more talkative. And the U.S. has not been able, or the I have not been able to get to them either. So So I would say it's AQ-Khan is really a symbol for him and several of his associates. And the interviews with the associates may end up being much more productive.
And what about the help that the Iranians have alleged to have gotten from former Soviet nuclear weapon scientists?
That's one of the more interesting parts of this. People always worried in the 90s that ex-Soviet nuclear weapons experts could, in their search for work, and it was, as you know, a very hard time in the Soviet Union, ex-Soviet Union in the early and mid-90s, that they may reach out and work for proliferant states and spread their knowledge. And here appears to be in a case where that actually happened. And it was certainly the Russian is saying he only did civil work, but the facts that the IAEA's established point to something very different. One is, he signed a contract in about 1995 with the head of the Physics Research Center, and that was the secret, the group heading the secret sector, which was involved in making nuclear weapons, and they also were running a parallel gas centrifuge program. And so he also worked in things in Iran where the evidence the IAEA brought back show that they had a very sophisticated way of initiating the high explosives that set off or that are then compress the core and start the nuclear explosion. And so it's very important that if you're going to have a nuclear weapon, that the firing system be very precise, and that they have one that's of a very small diameter and depends on a diagnostic system that he's famous for.
This is not the Kryton system. This is
No. It's a very different type of system, and it's rather unique to the Soviet Union, from what I understand. We haven't confirmed that yet, but it appears that it is unique to a particular weapon state. It's not a normal one that you would see, for example, in pictures if you look on the web and are looking at systems, firing systems that have been declassified in the West. But more importantly, if you're going to do this, you have to have a way to measure how well this blast wave works. It has to be very smooth, very circular or spherical in nature. And so if you're going to develop this kind of system to set off a nuclear weapon, you have to be able to create a measuring system to tells you how well you're doing. And so his system of fiber optic cables connected to what's called a street camera was developed in the nuclear weapons program in Russia when he worked in it, and that's what you see on the Iranian device. And this is the information that the IAEA collected. And so you can't prove that he knowingly went in and was part of the weapons program, sitting with the weapons people designing things, but you can at least show that they took this guy's knowledge and then they designed a very effective initiation system for a warhead that's about 0.55 meters in diameter. And moreover, he seems to have had some involvement in setting up a test chamber at a military site named Parchin in Iran in about 2000 that would be used to test these kinds of initiation systems. And so he can claim, you know, I didn't know it was for nuclear weapons. He did say in the interview he had with the IA that he said it could have been used for that, whatever he provided. So he was aware that what he was offering, regardless of the kind of the overt cover for this, was nuclear weapons. So it's, I think it's a situation where, and I've seen this many times, I mean, when people help another country's nuclear weapons program, they'll always have a cover story. And you sometimes you can get them to confess, sometimes you can't. This guy chooses not to confess and sticks, in a sense, sticks to his story. But nonetheless, his information was vital to the Iranians as they tried to construct basically an implosion system. And his signature is all over it.
And he worked, this Russian, he worked with Moshe Fakhrizadeh, right?
No, it's not clear who he... Fakhrizadeh says he didn't know him. Uh-huh. He worked with a guy named Dr. Shamarati, who was head of the Physics Research Center in the 90s.
I see.
And, you know, who he knew is hard to figure out, but nonetheless, he had this contract with the head of the Physics Research Center, Dr. Shamarati.
I see. And who's had access to him? I mean, where is he now?
He's Ukrainian. He worked for a couple decades, two or three decades, in their nuclear research and development facility at Chelyabinsk 70. Mm-hmm. And then he left and went to Ukraine after the fall of the Soviet Union, and he tried to set up a business basically making nano diamonds, and it didn't go very well. And he ended up working for the Iranians, and certainly the cover is nano diamonds, but the end result is nuclear weapons. And then he went back after he worked with the Iranians. He actually went to Russia, and I understand maybe became a citizen there, and that's where he remains. And it was not easy for the IA to get to him, but they did and interviewed him, and it was a very important interview because he didn't deny that this happened. You know, that he did say he worked for Iran. So you have him in Iran, and talking about things and that confirm information from a member state that a certain type of initiator for a nuclear weapon's been built. And it has his signature all over it. So so that's an example where the IA gets information from a member state. It says, okay, we can't trust your information because, you know, you could have made it up. But they track down this Russian who's associated with it and then are able to say, look, these two pieces of information together create a picture that is more believable.
And triggering a nuclear device is one of the key parts of it in terms of the secrecy.
Yeah, and having diagnostic equipment.
Sure. And I remember George Kistikowski was one of the people that made the breakthrough during the Manhattan Project, and it is a big deal. So it sounds like, combined with AQ Khan and this Russian, they've got the information, but of course a number of their scientists have been killed, and the IAEA has not been able to talk to Fakhrizadeh, right?
No, that's Fakhrizadeh, right. I should say. I mean, it's one of the scientists killed, I was told recently, I haven't confirmed it, but he's told that he was somehow associated with kind of this initiation process, slightly different, a different aspect of it, but still associated with the initiation. So the targeting of these scientists, which I deeply oppose, I mean, I think it's a very bad tactic and not an effective one. But nonetheless, whoever is killing these scientists knows was aiming, at least in two cases I know of, for scientists who had been associated with the nuclear weaponization program.
So, you know, it wasn't so long ago that the CIA said that they were 5 years at least away from any kind of weapon. Apparently, the Iranians have, there are conflicting reports. They have enough for 4 bombs, fuel, in terms of enriched uranium, or do they not? I know that the Stuxnet apparently slowed down the centrifuge system, but I think that's back up and running. So, in terms of nuclear fuel, if they've got the triggering and if they got the advanced design, all they need is the fuel, right?
Well, and the fuel is the long pole in the tent. I mean, it's they still have some work on the weaponization to make it reliable enough to put on a missile. And so that I think the IAEA assessed in its own internal reports they know enough to, and are able to build a crude nuclear weapon if they choose to do it, crude explosive device.
By the way, that's the thing that most alarms the Israelis, isn't it? The idea that a device that can be handed off to Hezbollah, if it's on a ballistic missile, then it has a return address.
That's right, but it's both worry the Israelis. I mean, but the long pole in the tent remains the enriched uranium, and in the IAEA report yesterday, it's clear that there appears to be a trend of downward performance at the main enrichment site at Natanz, and also Iran's been trying to build replacement centrifuges that are much more reliable and more capable of enriching uranium, and that part is going slowly. And so I think on the enrichment side, we have a break, and I would imagine there's all kinds of efforts to have Stuxnet 2, 3, and 4 to try to make life even harder for the Iranians. Because I think one thing that's really clear is that, you know, negotiations aren't going great, but that's really the ultimate goal, is to get negotiations that settle this. And the IAEA's put on a report on the table that said, look, Iran, here's what we think you did, and if Iran comes clean about nuclear weaponization, a lot of this, and verifiably dismantles anything that's left, a lot of this problem can disappear. And on the other side is military strikes are continuously proposed, but it's a horrible idea with horrible consequences, and need to be avoided. I mean, it's just not a way to solve this problem, and it probably won't be effective anyway. It may set them back for a couple of years, but it's not going to set them back for 5 or 10 years based on everything I've been seeing or hearing from, and we poll countries, and we hear this from Israel, Europe, whoever you ask. You don't get anyone saying, oh, we can set them back 5 to 10 years. So it's temporary in the end, and you're going to make them incredibly mad. And so you may end up causing them to speed up their effort. They don't have a Manhattan-style project going in Iran to get nuclear weapons, and the IAEA report yesterday shows that. You bomb them, you could get one. And so what do you then do? And this because we don't want them to get nuclear weapons. That's a high priority of many countries. And I would say even a country like Russia doesn't want to see Iran with nuclear weapons. And so what do you do? And that's where the whole role of sanctions become more important, but sanctions to disrupt their program, to keep them from getting the raw materials they need for their nuclear program. And that's going fairly well. They have shortages now of key materials for the nuclear program. As the tension rises, you're going to see more things like Stuxnet. You're going to see more sabotaging of equipment that Iran is seeking to buy overseas illegally. And so we're moving. If you don't want military strikes, and I don't, you don't think negotiations will work. I do want them to work, but they're not. Then you're moving toward a kind of a Cold War. And I must say, as an American, an older American, we know how to do a Cold War. Iran, we have a lot more capabilities to do a Cold War than Iran has. And so if I were Iran, I would think carefully about the coming confrontation, because we did things to the Soviet Union that can be done to Iran that can seriously set back their nuclear program, and there's not a shot fired. So I think and those efforts are being developed now, and I think intelligence agencies are getting more excited. And even in Israel, you've had a recent revelations by a former head of the Mossad. He certainly knows what this means, and that if we turn loose our intelligence agencies, a lot of problems could develop in the nuclear program in Iran to set them back even further.
So just in closing then, David Albright, you don't think that we can live with an Iranian bomb? We seem to be living with a North Korean.
I don't think we can live with an Iranian bomb. I mean, it's just not... if they get nuclear weapons, we may not even know what happens. This is looking out 2-3 years from now. But if you've got them contained and you're engaged in a Cold War, you actually may be able to keep them from doing it, from crossing that line, because they're going to be scared of getting caught. I mean, there's a lot of intelligence operations just to find out what's going on. This document released by the IAEA represents tremendous intelligence penetrations of secret parts of the Iranian program that have then been shared by these member states that have done it. There's a lot more information that went into the report. The revelation of the Qom site, intelligence operation found it. And so you have Iran is increasingly nervous about doing things in secret. because it has to worry about getting caught. Stuxnet has a remarkable amount of intelligence in it about in the Natanz site, where the intelligence in this case was used to destroy centrifuges, and that can be done again. So I think it is intolerable to accept Iranian nuclear weapons. We don't need to live with them. And there are strategies that will make it harder for them to do it, delay them, and also serve to deter them from making the decision to build nuclear weapons. And there's a way out of this for Iran. I mean, the easiest way we see out is that they come clean on their nuclear weaponization efforts, and it's done in a verifiable manner by the IAEA. And then questions about their enrichment program will probably greatly diminish. If we don't believe they want nuclear weapons, and we've seen them give up a program involving nuclear weaponization, you can start to trust them with uranium enrichment. And this is the route that others have taken. This is the route really Libya took. It's the route South Africa, the apartheid government in South Africa took. It's more or less the route Brazil took. And it's also, this isn't well known, in Taiwan in the late 80s when they had a nuclear weapons program and were getting ready to separate plutonium as part of that, in a very secret arrangement, they took that route with the United States. And allow the United States to witness the dismantlement of their nuclear weapons program. So I think it's a well-trod path, and Iran is being offered that as a way out. If it truly doesn't want nuclear weapons, there's a come clean about the past nuclear weaponization program.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here, David Albright.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Albright, his founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, a nonprofit, nonpartisan institution dedicated to informing the public about science and policy issues affecting international security. From 1992 to 1997, he was associated with the International Atomic Energy Agency's Action Team, and in 1996 became the first non-governmental inspector of Iraq's nuclear program. He has written extensively on the subject of nuclear weapons and their proliferation, and his latest book is Peddling Peril: How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Berlusconi. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Alexander Stiller, who is a San Paolo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia University. He is the author of Benevolence and Betrayal, Five Italian Jewish Families Under Fascism, Excellent Cadavers, The Mafia and the Death of the First Italian Republic, The Future of the Past, and The Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture Was Taken Over by a Man Named Silvio Berlusconi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Stiller.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin, though, some of your writings about Berlusconi, who appears to be finally, apparently, prepared to exit the scene, although he's not even entirely clear about that. You've suggested that the era of Berlusconi has turned Italians' political life into something that resembles some strange cross between a Mexican soap opera and Suetonius' description of the imperial excesses of the Caesars. What was his appeal then, given the brazen and embarrassing nature of his tenure?
Well, his appeal is based on some quite real and solid things, along with other things that we can discuss. Initially, he entered politics because the five main center-right parties that had together in coalition governed Italy during the post-World War II period all dissolved in the wake of a huge corruption investigation that happened in the early 1990s, leaving almost half of the Italian electorate effectively unrepresented. Berlusconi, with his huge personal fortune and media empire, was in a position to fill that void. So he was serving a genuine need that part of the electorate had, which was to be represented, and he was able to do it more ably than others. Also, some of the things that Americans might find hard to understand, his corruption charges against him, that he could continue functioning as a politician with so much negative baggage, works differently in Italy in that, for example, Italy has the largest concentration of small businesses in Italy among Western European countries, I think 3 million. Small businesses of 5 employees or fewer, these are kind of mom-and-pop shops, and they function in part by not declaring all of their income and taxes. And so they are cooking their books. So having a prime minister who has legal problems of his own isn't altogether unwelcome. He's not going to send the tax inspector after you the way some other parties might. And so that actually has a constituency. So things that would be a liability in other places aren't necessarily there. And the third factor is the continuing reach of his media, his ability to use it. And, 70% of Italians get their news from television. And a lot of the things that you or others might have been shocked by or amused by are in some cases not even explained on Italian TV. For example, when Berlusconi called a German deputy in the European Parliament a concentration capo, that was not broadcast on the main state channel.
Was when he called Obama suntanned and his wife suntanned, did that come through?
Well, that got a little bit, but, it always with Berlusconi's spin on it. I'm just joking. What's the matter? Doesn't everybody have a sense of humor? And, there you are dealing also with a cultural blind spot. Italians are not used to dealing in much with people of color, and therefore they're not sensitized to those issues. So that also would have just played differently there than it would here, where we have such a long history with problems of race. But also, for example, the things that, I remember when Berlusconi at a meeting of the European heads of state said, let's lighten things up and talk about soccer and women, and turned to German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder and said, you, Gerhard, who have had 4 wives, why don't you talk to us about women? This went over very badly and was considered a gaffe. And I thought about it, how could such a smart man say something so foolish? And then I thought, well, what are the 2 main topics of conversation at the average Italian bar? They're soccer and women. And so there's a kind of populist appeal that Berlusconi has that's actually quite recognizable in our political culture. Many of our politicians go out of their way to mangle their syntax and to leave the G off of their gerunds and saying just hanging around in order to sound like ordinary guys, to build a kind of interclass appeal and a kind of populist, just folks kind of manner. And Berlusconi does the same thing. There's a populism in his womanizing, in his joking around, even in off-color jokes, that has a kind of populist appeal. And Berlusconi, one of the secrets to his success, is having had a cross-class appeal, winning working-class voters who would have traditionally voted for the left because they identify with him personally, even if they don't agree with all of his policies, and in some cases are actually hurt by them.
Well, of course, the fact that he's sort of a wink and a nod to the average Italian who doesn't pay their taxes, the bill is now due, given the shuddering cost of Italy's debt, which has now reached the critical 7 points, which is considered unsustainable. And of course, you've suggested that the way that he is being successful is he's kept information out of the press about what's really happening with the economy, and those that were crying, trying to point out what was really happening, he attacked them as defeatists.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a predicate, though, you have to describe, I think, the history of Italian politics in the post-Cold War era, given the Cold War construction of the Christian Democrats as a ruling party, suitcases full of CIA cash along with the Vatican in this idea of keeping the left out of power. Similar thing happened in Japan with the ruling party there. How is it now, since the Cold War is over? Has there been a redress, given the initial concern was of the Italian left taking over? Because, after all, during World War II, the communists were the only ones who fought the fascists, and there was a legacy of support for them.
Mm.
And we, of course, here in the United States, did everything we could to keep them down in the fear that they would
well,
be...
Well, one of the things that's contributed to the crisis of Italy, and one of the things that's helped keep Berlusconi in power, is that the left, which is composed in part of pieces of the former Italian Communist Party, doesn't itself have a clear vision of what it wants to do. Its support is fragmented, and it doesn't have an entirely clear vision. You know, Berlusconi, part of his appeal was that he offered a very clear dream or vision. He could actually make people dream. What he offered them was a kind of fantasy. It was a kind of sugar rock candy mountain of unlimited prosperity that he would somehow be able to produce. The left, instead, a little bit like the Democrats in this country, have become the belt tighteners, the people who soberly want to roll up their sleeves and bring the accounts of state into balance. So they're offering a kind of slightly kindler, gentler version of market democracy, but they're also very big on responsibility and bringing the financial house into order. And while that's entirely necessary, it doesn't make people dream and it doesn't get people excited. And it's a very far cry from the kind of workers' paradise the left was able to hold out as a vision in the past. And so the left hasn't really rearticulated what it is, what kind of society it wants to create, other than a slightly more efficient, slightly more humane version of the capital society that Berlusconi represents. And so there's a crisis on the left as well as a crisis on the right.
Well, Alexander Stiller, you have described Berlusconi as he's escaped this endless drip. He survived 50 no-confidence votes, and more than 50, I believe. He's also, at this point, currently defended in 3 trials for bribery, tax fraud, abuse of power, and paying for sex with a 17-year-old girl. Presumably, if he leaves power, he'll lose some of his immunity. But what you've described it as is the personization of power. So
Yes. Is
he a sort of a Donald Trump with real money, or could you describe him as a Rupert Murdoch with a libido?
Well, I think all those things. I once wrote that, you know, if you combine the fortune of Bill Gates with the star power of Arnold Schwarzenegger with the media power and aggressiveness of a Rupert Murdoch, threw in ABC, CBS, and NBC into the bargain, and the kind of swagger of a big sports owner like Ted Turner or
Mark Cuban, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You'd get a little bit of the combined flavor and power of somebody like Berlusconi. So he combines a lot of elements that are very recognizable in American life, the entrepreneur in politics like Ross Perot, the politics of anti-politics, which we see a great deal of here, where, let's say, Sarah Palin says, you know, it's enough to be a mom to know what to do when you get into office, as if there's nothing in particular you need to know about policy or programs, that almost willfully saying, or Herman Cain saying, I don't need to know the names of the heads of states, regarding politics as a dirty negative field, and therefore the farther you away are from it and the less you know about it, you actually get a certain street credibility with some voters. So Berlusconi has played on elements that are actually quite common to politics around the world. We saw in the Murdoch scandal that unfolded earlier this year elements that were very eerily similar to what goes on in Italy, the using of tabloids to intimidate people, break stories that embarrass people, or the threat of doing that, keeping politicians at your heel. So there are all kinds of things that Berlusconi has used that are very much part of the world that we all live in, that are part of the way politics are done these days.
Well, Alexander Stiller, though, it's one thing to have contempt for politics in the way that Herman Cain proudly doesn't know any world leaders, but it's another thing to have contempt for democracy, which I think you could make that argument. I mean, it's probably no accident that Berlusconi's quite close to Vladimir Putin of Russia. You know, the fact that he's brought in former showgirls into parliament, made 2 of them government ministers, brought in a couple of dozen showgirls in their mid-20s to become candidates for the European Parliament. One was a weather girl for his television network. Again, it may be amusing, but isn't there an element of contempt for democracy?
There is. There is a strong authoritarian streak to Berlusconi, and I read just the other day a somewhat disturbing polling study that showed the percentage of Italians that value democracy has gone down quite a bit, and those who consider either no difference between an authoritarian government and a democratic one, or prefer an authoritarian one, has grown quite a bit, that the kind of weakening of the institutions that Berlusconi has done by personalizing power in the way that he's had, it has a very corrosive effect on democracy. And we do see elements, you mentioned Putin, and that's a good example. You also have things like Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, where you have a formal democracy. Elections are held every so often, but media is heavily controlled, and government is used to reward friends and punish enemies. And you have something that's a kind of weird hybrid between a kind of populist democracy with authoritarian streak to it. And Berlusconi is kind of somewhat in that ilk.
So just in closing then, Alexander Stiller, he's trying to come across as being a responsible party here. I mean, even though he was caught writing traitor as the vote went against him, and I think eight of his own deputies in the lower chamber defected, the entire opposition didn't show up for the vote. So he can make the argument, well, that I'm sacrificing myself for the health of Italy. But he's also suggesting that maybe there'll be new elections, and he suggested that the alternative to him would be European technocrats, which I guess is a dig at Brussels. What do you think is the likely outcome of this latest turn in this endless soap opera?
Well, I mean, I think that from what we've seen today, in which the markets in Italy reacted very badly to the fact that Berlusconi's plans were unclear and his resignation was conditional, may force him out of power sooner. I think it's, you know, likely that Italy is going to have to, because we are in the middle of an economic emergency. The current parliament will have to come together with an austerity package, which is somehow convincing to Europe and convincing to the economic markets, and calms down this kind of panic, and then that they will have to proceed toward elections in relatively short order, because it's clear that Berlusconi has lost the mandate of heaven. He doesn't have the confidence of the country and of his own majority behind him. So one of the things that the opposition would like to do is to go to elections with a new electoral law, because Berlusconi passed an electoral law favorable to him before the last elections, reintroducing a proportional system, which has led to a lot of fragmentation. So we may get a new electoral law and elections, and then we'll see what happens.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alexander Stiller.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Stiller, who's the San Paolo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia University. He has been a contributor to the New York Times, La Repubblica, the New York Review of Books. He's the author of Benevolence and Betrayal, Five Italian Jewish Families Under Fascism, Excellent Cadavers, The Mafia and the Death of the First Italian Republic, The Future of the Past, and The Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture Was Taken Over by a Man Named Silvio Berlusconi. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the very hopeful results in democratic elections that took place yesterday here in the United States. By the time you read this letter, I'll be out of your life. Gone forevermore, but I guess I'll survive. I'm gonna leave my records and a forward address. Ain't you glad, honey, that I'm off of your chest? We believe in your power to lead without fear. Not above. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about American politics, foreign policy, and the intersection of money and politics. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Berman.
Hey, Ian, thanks for having me back.
And clearly the results of the elections yesterday in Maine, Arizona, in Mississippi, and in Ohio indicate, I think, that the voters are basically saying to the Republicans that you've gone too far.
Exactly. I mean, we've seen since the 2010 election, Republicans passed a lot of very radical pieces of legislation, and this was really the first time that voters could challenge them. It's very difficult to actually organize recall campaigns to put issues on the ballot and then to have them actually overturn existing law, but that's what happened in Maine, for example. That's what happened in Ohio. So that was a pretty clear rebuke of the Republican governors there, and I think it showed that the conservative wave that allowed a lot of Republicans to win in 2010 has ebbed somewhat. And voters might not be crazy about President Obama or the Democrats, but they're unhappy with the radical agenda of the GOP. They don't see them addressing the economy or making it better either. And so we have a very volatile political climate where when one of the parties takes it too far, and in this case, the Republicans clearly took it too far, there is a backlash, and we saw that in the results last night.
So it's not 2008 again, and it's certainly a rebuke of 2010. So what is it? What would you say it is?
I think we're somewhere in between. Let's say it's 2009. or let's say it's 2011. I mean, the dynamic is just its own dynamic where we don't have the progressive euphoria that followed Obama's campaign and that sense of hope that we had back then. But we also don't have this very strong conservative tide that swept so many Republicans in 2010. And voters now have had a chance to see what Republicans would do differently, and they clearly don't like the results. They don't like the results from Republican governors. They don't like the results from the Republican Congress. We've seen the approval ratings of both of those groups go down dramatically, and that's basically why the 2012 election is so up for grabs, because voters aren't really happy with either party, and so what we're seeing right now is this was a rebuke to the Republicans because they're the party in power. And I think we saw in 2006 we saw an anti-incumbent election, in 2008 we saw an anti-incumbent election, in 2010 we saw an anti-incumbent election, and I'm pretty sure we're headed towards another anti-incumbent election in 2012.
Could you say then, Ari Berman, that this is a victory for voting rights as it was in Maine, workers' rights as it was in Ohio, women's rights as it was in Mississippi, and immigrants' rights as it was in Arizona?
I do think for the most part that's fair to say. I mean, it isn't super clear-cut in some states, but yeah, I mean, it is true. If you look at Ohio, it was a major victory for labor rights. If you look at Maine, the fact that they restored Election Day registration there, which 60,000 people used in 2008, that was a major victory for voting rights. There was a bit of a setback in Mississippi, which became the seventh state to mandate government-issued photo ID since the 2010 election, but there was also a victory in Mississippi with the defeat of the personhood initiative in a very, very conservative, deep red state. And then in Arizona, you had an interesting situation where one of the most radical anti-immigrant legislators was actually repealed by a member of his own party, which goes to show you that the really strong anti-immigrant wing of the party, which I think includes most of the Tea Party, may not be in control of the balance of power everywhere, that a number of Republicans believe that being so far to the right on immigration is bad policy, but it's also bad politics, and you saw that in Arizona. So yeah, I mean, since the 2010 election, Republicans, it's funny, they ran on individual choice, and they always do, but then they restricted the rights of so many people, whether it's the right to organize or the right to vote or the right of individual choice of your own body. And basically, this was a rebuke of that overreach.
Again, I'm speaking with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. So starting with Maine, what the voters overturned there was a very popular law that allowed you to vote and register and vote on the same day. And frankly, it always amazes me how difficult it is to vote in this country with all the states having different rules, many of them extremely restrictive, going back to the Jim Crow era. This was one of the more liberal and more in line with the rest of the Western democracies, the state of Maine. Is that a signal, do you think, that these other efforts, which are very successful by the Republicans in many states to restrict voters' access, aimed at largely at the Democratic base, the poor and elderly, do you think there's any chance that other states can overturn it, or is it too late in Georgia?
Well, there is some question. In Ohio, for example, there's been a cutback on early voting and other portions of voting rights, and they do have enough signatures to put that on the 2012 ballot, which did two things. I mean, number one, it froze the implementation of the law, and number two, it gave voters a chance to actually cast judgment on it. My sense is that's going to be repealed too, because there's absolutely no reason to do what they did in Ohio, which is they cut early voting from 14 to 8 days before the election, and they banned early voting on the Sunday before the election. And the reasons they did that is because black churches historically mobilized their constituents on the Sunday before the election, and that's bad for Republicans. And so we've seen that not only in Ohio, but also in Florida. And there's really been this unprecedented war on voting by the Republicans since the 2010 election. You've had a dozen states pass very restrictive voting laws. That's never happened before in this country in such a short period of time since the, you know, post Voting Rights Act era. And really, this was the first chance in Maine for voters to actually do something about it. Now, a lot of the other laws are going to be difficult to overturn, and I don't know if we're going to see as enthusiastic of a repeal campaign. I mean, in Maine, they gathered 70,000 signatures in less than a month, so that's a pretty impressive organizing effort, and one that you won't necessarily see repeated across the country. The other thing that happened was a lot of these voting rights restrictions happened in red states where they're okay with them. But in Maine, you have a swing state that leans blue, and voters were not happy about it there.
So, Ari Berman, in terms of workers' rights, I saw Governor John Kasich of Ohio look quite chastened by the results. I mean, he was almost blindsided. Do you think he was sincere? Since, I mean, he's an ideologue. He goes from being a congressman to a Fox News commentator to a governor.
It's hard to know if he's sincere, but anytime you lose that badly, you have to appear at least contrite. And it is a difficult situation there because he's, you know, a governor of a very, very important battleground state, and they don't want this similar energy that workers and progressives and Democrats had in that state to carry over to 2012. Republicans know they absolutely have to win Ohio if they want to have a chance at winning back the White House. And so anytime voters rebel against you that seriously, you have to think about what you're doing and whether you've gone too far and whether you've lost the trust of the public. Kasich is now the second most unpopular governor in the country. Given how mad Americans are at their elected representatives, that's actually saying a lot.
Who's the most unpopular?
It was Scott, for a while, Governor Rick Scott of Florida, another Tea Party governor who has just governed like an absolute crazed right winger on so many different fronts. And if the election were held today down in Florida, he, I believe, would get crushed.
And he, of course, is a mega felon, having paid a fine of $1.5 billion. I believe it's one of the biggest fines in American history.
It was the largest Medicare fine in American history.
Right.
Medicare fraud.
So let's just turn then to the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I've spoken to a number of people in Zuccotti Park and also down here at Occupy Los Angeles. And there's a pretty consistent refrain amongst a lot of occupiers, if that's the right word, that they don't want to vote. They're not interested in voting. They certainly don't. They're not interested in becoming an extension of the Democratic Party. And they certainly don't see themselves as being in any way associated with the Republican Party. But doesn't what happened yesterday show that bad laws can be overturned if people get off their backsides and vote? I would think it indicates that people have to vote because there's an awful lot of bad laws out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they have to happen in tandem, right? I mean, the deep structural reforms that Occupy Wall Street and its related groups are talking about are very valid. The need to get money out of politics, the need to reduce the gap between the 1% and the 99% and restore a sense of fairness in American society. But there's also a lot of policy choices that come out of that, right? And if you don't vote, then you don't have a say in those policy choices. And we saw that in 2010, a lot of people of progressive and Democratic persuasions decided not to vote. As a result, a huge number of conservative legislators and governors were put in power, and they enacted a lot of very radical laws that, had there been a larger Democratic or progressive turnout, they wouldn't have been elected. They wouldn't have been able to push through those laws. So, yeah, it's important to occupy Wall Street, but you also, in a sense, have to occupy the polls, because simply sitting out an election leaves a major void. And the people that fill that void, they are the John Kasichs of the world. They are the Koch brothers of the world. They are the Tea Party. And those people are going to show up again in 2012. And so if progressives and Democrats don't show up, then conservatives will win again, and they'll continue to pass very radical pieces of legislation that are going to be very difficult to overturn.
So in closing, Ari Berman, what's the takeaway here? That politics are Pavlovian? And when things get terribly bad, do people react and then step up? Or
to some extent, yes. I mean, I do think that's true. Things got very bad in the Bush era, and people rallied around President Obama. Then there was a lot of disappointment, so they didn't vote. Conversely, Republicans were very motivated to vote. And then we saw recently, both in Wisconsin and then again on last night, a lot of Democrats getting energized again. And I think in 2012, both parties are probably going to be fairly energized. Republicans are going to be energized trying to defeat the president, and Democrats are going to be fairly energized trying to defeat some of these radical Republicans. They might not be as energized about President Obama, but I know all across the country, people are very energized by state and local issues right now, because the states have really become the real political battleground. So I do think this was a good night on the whole for Democrats, but it's hard to really know if it'll translate a year out into the next election.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Ari Berman.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He has written extensively about American politics, foreign policy, and the intersection of money and politics. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with David Albright, who is truly an insider in the murky, dark world of nuclear proliferation. He was on the IAEA's action team from 92 to 97, became the first non-government inspector of Iraq's nuclear weapons program. Clearly has very, very inside information. And the stuff we learned, for example, I didn't realize Taiwan had a secret nuclear program that was dismantled. I think a lot of information came out in this interview, particularly, of course, about Iran's nuclear program, which was the subject of this report that was just released by the IAEA. It's pretty convincing that AQ Khan's network gave them the designs for nuclear weapons, or Russians, nuclear scientists gave them the firing mechanism, the most sophisticated and highly classified part of a nuclear weapon. And it's just a matter of time before they get a nuclear weapon. He, of course, thought it was crazy to bomb them and kill their scientists, and feels that there is a way to negotiate out of this situation. Then I spoke with Alexander Stiller, the specialist on Berlusconi. He's written about him in lots and lots of outlets, and he really gave us a portrait of this sleazy guy, this titan of sleaze who combines the worst of Donald Trump and Rupert Murdoch. Hopefully his days are numbered, but Italy, he's leaving Italy in a complete disastrous state. And then finally, we spoke about the elections yesterday in Mississippi, Ohio, Arizona, Maine, very hopeful signs that people, when they get out to vote, they can reverse these terrible laws, which clearly the Republicans have overreached in the last couple of years, trying to shut down voters' rights, women's rights, immigrants' rights, and workers' rights. And people, when they show up at the polls, they can make a difference. And that was what happened yesterday. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. You can get this program by signing up for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Land here on the free, one time, one night in America.